Thank you for joining us today on Grant County Coronavirus Update for Wednesday, February 17th. You're here on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM, Silver City, New Mexico, online at gmcr.org. I'll be your host for today, Marcus Hansen. This week on Grant County Coronavirus Update, Jamie Newton hosts a panel of four experts on vaccine hesitancy and related topics on the coronavirus pandemic with Dr. Jagdish Khubchandani, Dr. Fred Koster, Jeff Fell, and Dr. Renee Dupre. But first, here's the news for the day. The New Mexico Department of Health on Tuesday announced 308 additional COVID-19 cases and 12 additional deaths related to the disease. There have been more than 180,000 cases of coronavirus reported in the state, with 3,550 total deaths as of Tuesday. 290 individuals do remain hospitalized in New Mexico with the disease. However, more than 303,000 people in the state have received their first dose of the two-shot vaccine for COVID-19, while 138,755 people have been fully vaccinated. This is according to the COVID-19 vaccine data dashboard. Also, according to that dashboard, more than 625,000 people have throughout the state have registered for the vaccine so far. In Grant County, the Department of Health reported 69 new COVID cases since last week, for a total of 1,435 cases. There are 778 reported COVID-19 cases as recovered, leaving 624 active cases in the county as of Tuesday, indicating a drop in active cases by 11 and 78 more people being recovered. There have been two reported deaths here in Grant County since last week. This brings the total to 33 local deaths. A reminder that New Mexico is now in Phase 1B of vaccine distribution. That means the vaccine is now available to residents in the following groups: individuals 75 years of age or older, individuals 16 or older with underlying medical conditions, including cancer, kidney disease, heart problems, and other chronic illnesses, individuals 16 years or older with intellectual or developmental disabilities, critical care workers, and nursing home residents and staff. The New Mexico Department of Health does encourage individuals in Phase 1A to continue to schedule their vaccines, as well as anyone in the state, as anyone can register online at vaccinenm.org. Again, that's vaccinenm.org. Users who have questions or do not have internet access can dial the following number. That is 1-855-600-3453 and press option 0 for vaccine support. Please note that individuals with developmental or intellectual disabilities may call the following number. That is 1-800-432-2080 to register for the vaccine. However, they still may register online at vaccinenm.org. A reminder that the COVID-19 vaccine does help your body learn to defend itself from the disease. You may feel uncomfortable for 2 or 3 days after you receive the vaccine. So after receiving the vaccine, you may feel some of the following side effects. They include muscle pain, soreness in your arm, body aches, chills, feeling tired, and a fever. Side effects are a sign that your body is building up protection from COVID-19. They may be uncomfortable, but they are far less harmful than getting COVID-19. The state's red to green public health order, in which counties are evaluated over a 2-week period for daily cases and test positivity rates, was updated last week. And as of February 10th, Grant County does remain in the yellow category. If you'd like to see specifics about the red to green reopening plan, you can go to cv.nmhealth.org. And with this update, Penny Park and all the playgrounds in the town are now open to the public as of February 8th. People using any of the town's parks must abide by the state's public health orders and the town's local ordinance. Face coverings and social distancing are required. Now look at the COVID-19 testing schedule. The HMS Mobile Clinic will be doing COVID testing and offering flu shots for adults only. Please do be aware that they are not offering COVID-19 vaccine shots at their mobile clinics. And they will be taking place today, Wednesday, February 17th, here in Silver City at Goff Park from 8:30 a.m. to 12 noon. And tomorrow, Thursday, from February 18th. And they'll be in the Cliff Gila area at the HMS Clinic from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. The schedule for next week is as follows. Monday, February 2nd, they'll be in Santa Clara at the Dollar General parking lot from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Tuesday, February 23rd, they'll be in Bayard at the Cobray High School parking lot from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Wednesday, February 24th, they'll be in Tyrone at the Tyrone Community Center. They'll be there from 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. And on Thursday, February 25th, they'll be in Animas at the Animas Clinic, and that is from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Also, Hidalgo Medical Services is making testing available Monday through Friday from 8:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at both their Silver City and Lordsburg locations. to register for that, please do so in advance at 575-388-1511. Again, that's 575-388-1511. Additionally, the Grant County Public Health Office and the Hidalgo County Public Health Office are providing free testing. The Grant County Public Health Office provides testing every Tuesday from 8 to 10 a.m. and then from 2 to 4. Testing at the Hidalgo County Public Health Office will be conducted every Thursday from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. To register for either one, you can go to cvtestreg.nmhealth.org. Again, that's cvtest.nmhealth. That's cvtestreg.nmhealth.org. For more ways to get tested here in Grant County, please do visit the website grantcountycoronavirusupdate.org. It's the beginning of tax season, and if you qualify for the 2020 Economic Stimulus Payment, also known as the individual payment from the COVID relief bill, but have not yet received it, make sure to claim your recovery rebate credit on your 2020 tax return. Visit irs.gov for more information. Also, printed copies of the Federal Form 1040, instruction books, and New Mexico tax forms are available outside the Silver City Public Library's Cooper Street doors during curbside pickup hours. The AARP Free Tax Assistance Program packets are also available in a box by the doors. You can also go online to taxaid.aarpfoundation.org or call the local AARP tax help number. That is 575-519-5988. Again, that's 575-519-5988. New Mexico households receiving Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program benefits, otherwise known as SNAP, will receive the maximum amount for their household size for the month of February as the state continues its response to the COVID-19 pandemic. This is according to the State Human Services Department. Individuals seeking to apply for SNAP benefits may do so online at yes.state.nm.us or by phone at 1-800-283-4465. And a reminder, at the Silver City Farmers Market, they do accept EBT and pandemic EBT cards and offer double up food bucks, which double your SNAP benefits. Basically, what you're doing is you're using your EBT card to get half off of all local purchases. Winter Farmers Market is held every Saturday from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. here in Silver City at the corner of Pope Street and College Avenue. That is in the Old Life Quest parking lot. Please do be aware that the Members Valley Mobile Food Pantry for today has been canceled, and that the Commons next regular food pantry distribution for Silver City, Tyrone, and Arenas Valley will be next Wednesday, February 24th from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. The Commons is located at 501 East 13th Street, which is next door to the Knights of Columbus building. For more information, contact the Commons at 575-388-2988 or visit their website. That is thecommonsgrantcounty.org. A consumer debt bankruptcy workshop will be held from 6 to 8 p.m. on Wednesday, February 24th via video and teleconference. At the workshop, an attorney will give a group presentation on bankruptcy, according to this news release. After the presentation, a one-on-one free consultation will be given by phone to people who register in advance. Call 505-797-6094 for details. Again, that's 505-797-6094 for more details. And if you'd like these resources and more, please do visit our website, grantcountycoronavirusupdate.org. And while you're there, you can also sign up for the mailing list, which comes out once a week on Wednesdays. Next up, Jamie Newton will host a panel of four experts on vaccination hesitancy, and related topics on the coronavirus pandemic.
This is the Coronavirus Update interview of February 17th, 2021 on Gila Mimbres Community Radio and KURU 89.1 FM in Silver City, New Mexico. I'm Jamie Newton, your host for today. Our program today brings together four expert guests to address a timely and crucial issue in the effort to overcome the coronavirus pandemic: vaccination hesitancy. That term refers to reluctance to accept vaccination among people who are eligible to be vaccinated. Dr. Jagdish Khubchandani is professor of public health at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces. He holds doctorates in clinical medicine and in health education and epidemiology. He's the lead author on a national assessment of COVID-19 vaccination hesitancy in the United States that was published in January of this year, just last month, in the Journal of Community Health. Dr. Khubchandani, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Newton, for having me.
And Dr. Fred Koster is a recently retired infectious diseases specialist in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Dr. Koster's career includes 50 years of immunology and vaccine research with 35 years of clinical infection control and treatment. In the past 15 years, Dr. Koster has focused on vaccine research in pandemic viruses and severe bacterial infections. Dr. Koster, it's good to have you back on Coronavirus Update.
Glad to be back. Thank you.
Regular listeners to Coronavirus Update will recognize our two local guests, both of whom have generously shared their expertise with us on this program frequently through the course of the pandemic. Jeff Fell, emergency manager and assistant fire chief of Silver City, and Dr. Rene Dupre, a public health consultant, are co-founders and coordinators of the Grant County Emerging Infectious Diseases Task Force, which, of course, currently focuses on the coronavirus pandemic. Thank you for returning, both of you, to Coronavirus Update.
Always a pleasure to be here, Jamie.
Thanks, Jamie, for having us again.
Dr. Koster, let's begin with a concise orientation to our current situation. Nationally and in New Mexico, what is the status of the coronavirus pandemic and efforts to control it? Specifically, why are mass vaccination programs essential?
Well, the good news is that the number of cases across the country have been decreasing. The number of deaths have been decreasing. The burden on the intensive care units is lightening a bit. The number of cases have decreased by over 50%, but that doesn't mean that we're out of the woods yet. It's still, we're still recording something between 90 and 100,000 cases a day. But the good news is that those numbers are coming down from this third and largest surge. Now, why that's happening is, of course, a top question. And we hear from experts at the national level that it's probably the application of social distancing and masks and not joining large gatherings, such as, you know, what occurred around the Christmas and New Year's holiday, and that some of the severe weather has driven people to be more isolated, and unfortunately, that's a good thing for holding down the epidemic. So the question also is, does vaccination contribute to these drop in cases? And a number of people feel that if it does contribute at this point, it's been small. And the reason that they say that is that the level of vaccination in the country is about 11 to 12%. Here in New Mexico, it's 14%. We're one of the two or three best states in the country. And then if you add on the immunity from substantial infections, not so much the light or asymptomatic infections, but maybe we're up around the 20% protected range. We don't know what level we'll be able to see a decrease in infections due to the vaccination. But from the lesson that was learned with Israel, once they got up to about 30% of the country being vaccinated, that's when they started to note decreased infections and deaths. So we're getting there, and that's good news.
Let me ask a sort of dark side question here and invite any of you to answer. I saw speculation today by one informed source that just possibly one reason for the reduction in new daily cases is that fewer people are getting tested. Maybe that's an effect of coronavirus fatigue. We all remember with some dismay that about a year ago, then President Trump said he had asked his staff to try to slow down the rate of testing because if you kept testing, you were going to see more cases. Whether or not that's a reason for people to decline testing, is there any evidence that fewer tests are being taken, and that's a reason why we're having drops in the number of confirmed cases. Anyone?
I think that there are probably some areas in the country where that may be true because the personnel that we're doing the testing have been shifted over into doing vaccination. My understanding and looking at the data from New Mexico, that's probably not the case here, although the others may have a better idea of that. But the testing in most places in the country has seemed to be continued at a good pace.
I think Dr. Rene Dupre and Jeff Fell, later on, you may comment on the availability, which we're trying to publicize, of free home tests that anyone can request now. And so that would help to offset any reduction of professional attention to testing, would it not? Jeff, could you comment on that?
Sure. Yes. The Department of Health did start promoting the at-home test. And I know that there is a couple of organizations here locally, some of them being some of the public school systems, have chosen to go that route with their random tests that they do among their staff. And so it definitely takes away the need for people to have to get out of their house to drive to a clinic or through a drive-through setting. It's not as invasive as the other tests, being that it takes a saliva sample. It does have a technological aspect to it, though, where folks have to be able to log into Zoom and to be verified on their identity and get some instructions to make sure that the sample is taken well. But it definitely is another testing option that needs to get publicized.
So that would underscore that in order to approach mass vaccination, this has to be a multi-method thing. It can't be limited to making available home tests to people who have the most advanced communication equipment. And I think this point will recur as we go through this discussion, that the coronavirus pandemic really does make it clear that this is a community enterprise. If anybody gets neglected, everyone remains at risk. So no one can say, I'll get mine and then I need not worry. Mass vaccination programs I asked about, and one objective is, I think, what's been referred to as herd immunity. Correct me, those of you who know more about this than I do, if I'm wrong here, but my understanding of herd immunity is that it refers to having a high enough proportion of a population with sufficient resistance so that a virus or a bacteria, in this case a virus, has more difficulty locating an available host. And in the case of a virus, without a host, there is no replication. So if enough people are resistant, then that will suppress the pandemic. So let me ask you, Dr. Koster, what is herd immunity? Did I express that right? How might herd immunity help to overcome the pandemic? And whether by vaccination or as a result of infection, do we really know what proportion of a population needs to be immune for us to say we've achieved herd immunity, we are on our way toward being in the clear? And I would invite anyone after Dr. Koster to speak to that as well.
Well, you're right. The herd immunity refers to the level of population immunity that suppresses the transmission, the spread of the virus. And at some level, there are too few susceptible people to become infected. Now, with this highly transmissible virus, that level may be higher than other viruses. People speculate that the number is somewhere between 70% and 90%. And nobody really knows what that magic number is. And there probably isn't really a sharp threshold for, stopping this highly transmissible virus. It'll still be back in the background, even if we do get up to, say, 90% herd immunity. The word herd, of course, comes from the fact that the early studies were done in in cows and diseases that were transmitted from cow to cow. It doesn't necessarily mean that people are part of a herd. At least I would rather not think of it that way. I think that I think the concept of herd immunity is solid, and we will achieve that by vaccination rather than by just letting infection go without vaccination, the so-called natural route.
And let me ask Dr. Khubchandani about that. You and I were speaking privately yesterday about this issue. I want to put this in the strongest possible terms because we've had some, I think, really appalling recommendations from people who are quite respected and have had national visibility. I will refer to Dr. Scott Atlas. He is a Stanford University anesthesiologist and also health policy analyst, who was appointed as a coronavirus advisor to then President Donald Trump in August of 2020. It was his view, as I've seen reported, that up to 99% of COVID infections cause no more than mild symptoms. And he advocated allowing younger and less vulnerable people to freely infect one another. And that would be a quick, cheap way to achieve herd immunity. I should point out, so that this is not damaging to Stanford University, very soon after that, a group of 78 of his former colleagues at Stanford Medical School signed a letter where they condemned his views as falsehoods and misrepresentations of science. So, Dr. Khubchandani, what's wrong with seeking herd immunity by just letting millions of Americans get sick with the coronavirus?
I'm glad we discussed this. I feel like these are not just dangerous statements, falsehoods, but, you know, we are playing with lives of people. We have seen these experiments in the history of mankind where people were deliberately exposed to infections and then we washed them over and we did clinical trials on them. We are not living in that past right now. So even if 99% people recover, the 1% who would die, and then among the 99% who recover, how many of them will have lifelong disabilities and damages? No one is accounting for that. And you are allowing people to be infected with a virus compared to giving them a vaccine, which is not a virus, which may have longer immunity. With this virus, if you let people get infected, there's no guarantee that all of us will be infected and generate enough immunity for a longer time to achieve herd immunity. So I don't know how they came up with these concepts of achieving herd immunity by infecting everyone. And it's, you know, somewhat embarrassing too when we have such scientific technological advancements. And here we are going to rudimentary ways of, as Dr. Koster said, treating humans like herds and cows.
So let me just ask if anybody wants to comment on the characterization of that view. Is it accurate? Do you agree with the Stanford University faculty members that this really constitutes falsehood and misrepresentation of science? Should we just set that aside and say allowing people to freely infect one another and accepting millions of deaths as a quick way to achieve herd immunity is an idea we should set aside permanently?
Yeah, permanently we should set it aside. And Dr. Koster brings an interesting point that we are never able to predict herd immunity in real time. For polio and all other diseases, we went back in history and we found how much is good enough for herd immunity. But in the middle of a pandemic, you cannot predict the percent people who have to be immunized to achieve herd immunity. And so the whole concept of herd immunity should be put aside and each one reach one, vaccinate everyone who's available and willing to take a vaccine.
Thank you. That is a very good, concise summary of a state of direction. And I'll just point out that when Dr. Koster said it might be somewhere between 70 and 90%, it could be higher. That 20% to 25% window, when we look at the American population, is loosely speaking 60 to 80 million people, a lot of lives to be toying with. Jeff Fell, let me ask you, because as the city's emergency manager, you're in daily communication with healthcare workers who order and dispense vaccines. You're an EMT, you provide vaccinations, And I'd just like you to summarize your experience here locally with vaccine hesitancy. Who's reluctant to be vaccinated and why? We'll be talking later, but you may want to comment now on what you think can be done to reassure people who feel uncertain or fearful or just want to wait and see what happens to other people who are stepping forward first. And are we at any risk of having doses of vaccines that are vulnerable as the days pass and will ultimately not be usable sitting around because of vaccine hesitancy? Are we at that point yet? Jeff Fell.
Thanks, Jamie. Yeah, we are definitely not at that point right now as far as running the risk of any going to waste. I can 100% confidently say that there has not been one single dose of vaccine that's been provided in Grant County that has gone to waste. If anything, our demand for the vaccine is currently far outpacing the supply. And so although we acknowledge the fact that there are some of our population who are hesitant about the vaccine, and we are, like you said, we'll talk a little bit later about the preparations that we're doing in education and outreach to try to reach those people. Our goal right now is to get as many vaccines to the people who are in line waiting right now. And we can go to the New Mexico Department of Health has recently started up a vaccine dashboard. And just as Dr. Koster said earlier, New Mexico is, one of the leading states in the country as far as getting vaccinations out. And then within Grant County, we are actually one of the top counties in the state at the moment. According to the DOH's website, we have partially vaccinated about 19% of Grant County's population to date. That's a website that they're updating on a daily basis. And then the fully vaccinated people with their second dose is about half of that. So they're estimated about 8% of our population is fully vaccinated. So we are definitely above, the national average as far as getting the vaccines out to our citizens, which is something that all of us in the healthcare community are very proud of. But when we talk about vaccination hesitancy, I like to break people down into four categories. There's those who absolutely want it. And there's those who are not 100% sure, but if given the opportunity, they'll probably take it. There's those that aren't 100% sure and they're choosing the wait and see approach. And then there's those who are just more strongly opposed to it for whatever reason. And we're working through those first two categories right now. There is a long line of people waiting and wanting that vaccine. And then there's a big population of the people, I think, that are in the wait and see category. And they're just watching the news, which sometimes can send out some inaccurate information. But mostly they're listening to their neighbors. They're having conversations with their doctors. They're having conversations with their friends who might have gotten it. And so, that group is the people that I really try to work on personally, the people who are waiting and seeing. And I can give my personal experience. I can refer to them to other people who've gone through it. And a lot of times that's all they need is a little bit of reassurance that, everything that they hear that is inaccurate is exactly that, inaccurate. As we move forward, when we get to the point that we have extra shots and we're trying to convince people, I think we'll be in a good place then, because that means everybody who wants one has got it, and that's a big portion of the population. But for those who are more strongly opposed, time, it's going to take some of those people, they want to wait a year or more to see what the results might be of this, things that they've heard that might be long-term. They need education from people they trust, like their family doctor or friends and family, or unfortunately a bad experience. That might be something that changes people's mind also. They have a tragedy that occurs maybe within their family or a close friend. And now all of a sudden, it's not just something I hear on the news, it's personal. And I know a lot of people here locally who have personal tragic stories of having had dealt with this virus, and their opinion of the response to this and the management of it has changed 180 degrees from back in the summer to now. It's real now.
So personal experience makes a great deal of difference. And Jeff Fell, sort of a sobering note, what you just said, that sometimes people are willing to take serious action because they've experienced or come into contact with a real tragedy, and now all of a sudden it's meaningful to them. But it seemed to me that I heard you being essentially optimistic. That is, that right now, all of the doses we have in Grant County are being effectively used for people who are eligible and who are classified as high priority because they're healthcare workers or essential workers or vulnerable. And we can hope and perhaps even expect that as more and more people accept vaccinations, they will be in communication with other people who for some reason are hesitant, and those who initially are a little hesitant, but not a whole lot, may be tipped over toward willingness because now they know somebody who got along just fine with it. And by the time we get to the people who are saying, I wouldn't be caught dead without a vaccination or with one, those numbers will be very small. Would that seem accurate to you?
Yes, I think you summarized that really well. You know, we're just working as a healthcare community to get these out as quick as we can. And you're right, everyone here in Grant County is using the state's registration website, which prioritizes people. We get a lot of questions about how that works. And most of us here locally don't understand how the state's registration system is picking people, but it's not really our place to try to understand the system. And every week, you know, we hold these clinics and we get more shots in arms, and it's just the work that's being done right now.
If you've just joined us as a listener, this is the Coronavirus Update interview of February 17th, 2021, a panel discussion on KURU 89.1 FM in Silver City, New Mexico, and streaming on the World Wide Web at gmcr.org. I'm Jamie Newton with a panel of four expert guests, and our topic is vaccine hesitancy during the coronavirus pandemic. Dr. Khubchandani, you and your colleagues published a national study in January 2021 on demographic and cognitive correlates of vaccination hesitancy. In other words, characteristics of people, their beliefs and attitudes and social group identifications as well, that help us understand why some people who are eligible for coronavirus vaccinations delay or refuse to be vaccinated. This is kind of a tall order, but you did this for a Las Cruces Bulletin article. Could you summarize the principal findings of your study and tell us what those results imply for practical efforts to vaccinate enough Americans to suppress the pandemic? And we'll then explore details from that. Dr. Khubchandani.
Yeah, we recruited 1,800 plus people across the nation, and we asked them in late summer and fall 2020, if there was a COVID vaccine available today, would you take it free of cost? And 22% people said they're not likely to accept that vaccine. And we wanted to dive deeper into why would someone deny a vaccine? And we find that African-Americans, Hispanics, those who have children at home, those who are self-identified Republicans, and those who don't believe that COVID is a serious disease or if they could be infected were more likely to deny a vaccine. Now, you know, as we have discussed throughout the show, there are certain groups of people who are vaccine hesitant, and we cannot label them in one group. As Jeff said, there are different types of people. Some are traditional anti-vax. Some are just scared of this new virus. And it differs how likely people are. Some are very likely to accept it. Some are somewhat likely, definitely not likely, or definitely not wanting. So, you know, we wanted to do this early because I think throughout the pandemic, the one thing that we have not done well is having a foresight. So we did this study earlier. I think vaccine hesitancy is maybe not a major issue today because we have a huge demand but lack of supply. But once we get to a place where there's enough supply, I think then it would be a major issue to cross that last leg and vaccinate enough people, because then you'll start looking at the real vaccine hesitant people who are chronic and refractory populations who traditionally don't want vaccines.
So it's very important that we get a start on addressing vaccine hesitation while there are still not enough doses for everybody who actually wants it. Dr. Renee Dupre, there's a point that's been mentioned several times here that I'd like you to address. I've heard you do this in a way that I think is really understandable to lay people without scientific training. That is that these vaccines are not little doses of virus. They are based on genetic instructions. That's why it's called a messenger. Genetic instructions that tell the body how to become resistant. But we need to reassure people, I think, don't we, that we're not making them somewhat sick, a little bit sick. We're actually giving the body instructions on how to defend itself. Could you speak to that, Dr. Dupre?
I'm sure. The current vaccines that are available in the United States, now, I remember we have a lot of different vaccines out there, and all of them are using different mechanisms. But the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine, which we're giving right now in Grant County, are two mRNA vaccines. And that sounds kind of fancy, but those vaccines are based on, they basically give a set of instructions to your cells about how to make the protein that your body needs to fight the virus. And that's all that it does. It's not the traditional, remember the old smallpox inoculation, the milkmaids didn't get the smallpox because they'd already had a little bit of inoculation. It's not our traditional vaccine message. And that's, some people are really nervous about that. Wow, it's a new technology. But what's really important to remember is this technology has been being worked on for at least two decades, maybe more, that people and using this technology to address multiple different diseases. Moderna, the company that created one of the vaccines we're using now, is using this technology, investigating its use in diseases ranging from MS to heart disease to see if we can find other ways to use it. So it's not just something that sprang up out of the blue in a year. And I think that's really important for people to recognize that. And the other piece is that these vaccines have been, we've been working on coronavirus vaccines for a really long time. We've known for a really long time that coronaviruses as a family have posed the threat of just the type of disease outbreak that we're experiencing right now. And so ever since SARS-1, remember when that hit in Toronto and we were all really worried about it, and rightly so, researchers have been trying to find a vaccine for that. So even though this seems like, wow, we developed this vaccine overnight, we did and we didn't, right? Or the vaccine, I shouldn't say we, because I had nothing to do with developing it. But the vaccine researchers, people who develop vaccines, have been working on both the technology and specifically a vaccine for a coronavirus for many, many, many years, decades even.
Let me ask anyone who would like to address this. There is a particular advantage, as I understand it, of the mRNA technology, which makes it quite different from, say, the flu vaccines that we're all familiar with. I've been told year after year that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention would be trying to estimate the characteristics of the influenza we would confront next year. And then they spend months and months and months making egg-based and some non-egg-based vaccines that are to address these variations on the influenza. And I believe it's true, I'd like one of you to comment on this, that should there be sufficient mutation in a dangerous direction of the coronaviruses, it is possible to adjust characteristics of the vaccines here very quickly to specifically alter their response. Dr. Kupchandani, I see you nodding vigorously. Could you say a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, as Renee said, that these vaccines have been worked on for decades and decades. You know, to be honest, I was placing my bets that these vaccines would be effective 50 to 60%, just like the seasonal influenza. But when they announced 80 plus percent, 90%, I thought that was a game changer, that we have a new technology. It can be reprogrammed easily compared to the traditional viruses where we inject weaker dead virus into people. Those cannot be reprogrammed, but these vaccines use a component of the virus and it can be reprogrammed. It can be manipulated. to reach out to broader population, even with variants. And, you know, I also want to mention when some people hear about vaccination side effects from this new technology, if you have fever, I would hope that you don't consider it as a serious side effect. It actually tells you that your body is responding to this new technology vaccine. So let's hope that people don't exaggerate that, oh, there are serious side effects. You know, 25 million people are infected and 500,000 died in the United States. 25 million people were vaccinated. How many died? And that's how we have to look at these numbers with the vaccine compared to the disease. And we choose one of the two.
And so 25 million people vaccinated, and I don't actually know the total number thus far nationwide, some of you may. About how many, Dr. Khubchandani or others, about how many of the vaccinated people have been killed by the vaccine itself?
You know, the CDC website said there are 300 cases that are being investigated. We cannot say with confidence that these people died because of vaccine. And even unfortunately, even if 300 died, that's substantially less than 500,000 who died of infection. So same rate of infection and same rate of vaccination, what would you choose given the chances of death? I would go for a vaccine.
Yes, Jeff, Phil.
Yeah, I'd just like to follow up with doctor's comment on that. Here locally, there was a time not very long after the vaccine was distributed here in the county that we had hit about 1,000 cases of COVID in our county. I could be wrong on that number, but the number of cases of COVID in our county were about equal with the number of vaccines that we had given out. And at the time, our death rate in the county was around 20 people, and we didn't have one adverse reaction from any of the vaccines that had given in the same number of people. So I just find that very intriguing that from a national level down to a county level, it's fairly obvious when you look at the numbers that this is the safe and most effective way to go.
And so our topic here is vaccine or vaccination hesitancy. And one major take home from this discussion is that if you're trying to decide what is a more and what is a less risky course of action during the coronavirus pandemic, your chances are far better if you allow yourself to be vaccinated when you get that opportunity than if you say, I'll just take my chances if I get sick. Dr. Khubchandani, thinking about demographic variables, such things as race, ethnicity, age, whether you have children at home, rural or urban dwelling, these were predictors that your study found helped to understand who would be resistant to the idea of getting vaccinated and who would not. In Grant County, the most recent census data that I could find tell us that we're about evenly divided between white, non-Hispanic, and Hispanic people, maybe a few more Hispanic people, 50%, about evenly divided, 51% female, 49% male. And although it's not a direct correlate of rural versus town dwelling, about 24% of our residents and 37% of children under 18 are classified as living in poverty. Those are not variables that translate directly onto the categories that you and your colleagues used in your study, but from those, that kind of a limited profile of Grant County residents, Dr. Khubchandani, can you say anything about the likely prevalence of vaccine hesitancy in Grant County and what we might do to address it from these data?
Yeah, I looked at the numbers in Grant County, and it does seem like it's not the highest performing county in the nation based on income, education, urbanicity. And so I think this is a county that has a lot more rural people living in poverty with lesser education and a higher proportion of Hispanics compared to the national profile. So I would, and maybe Jeff would have to know this, that right now you'll have many more people wanting to vaccinate, but eventually you'll reach a time when you'll have a challenge reaching out to those remote rural people with less education who live in poverty because they live with a different mindset. It's oftentimes hard to reach them. Especially with large Hispanic populations, you know, if we don't have the materials in Spanish, we don't have community leaders standing up. And I think we are not even doing a good job nationally on racial minorities. The last we saw, President Obama promised that he'll take a vaccine. as a big motivator for African American communities. But so far that has not happened. So we need more national minority leaders, men, or people in rural communities, churches, faith-based groups who can stand up and bring more volunteers who want to be vaccinated.
People who are trusted and respected among those who might be most hesitant. And I would like to say, not only to you, Dr. Kuchandani, because it's encouraging, but to all of our listeners, that among the initiatives of the Grant County Emerging Infectious Diseases Task Force is that we are producing, as best we can, outreach materials that are in both English and Spanish. Those are the two dominant languages in the area. And so when we have a little leaflet, one side is English, the other side is Spanish. And a lot of our people actually prefer to flip back and forth. They speak most comfortably in what we sometimes say is Spanglish, you know, a little bit of English, a little bit of Spanish. Dr. Kuchandani, watching your face, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you mentioned that you're putting out those efforts because, you know, as I said, in the pandemic, you have to be having a lot of foresight. You know, pandemics are always bad, but they are made worse by political failures and professional incompetence. And we are always, you know, never trying to run ahead. We are always reactive and not proactive. So while we have the people who want the vaccine, we also have to think about those who are hesitant and keep them in the loop and, you know, coordinate, communicate as much as we can.
Let me tell our listeners that we are nearing the end of this panel discussion. We have a few minutes left, but all of my guests have said that they expect that they can be available for a follow-up next week. There are several important questions, such as the implications of having the newer, more infectious variants of the coronavirus appear in the United States and even in New Mexico. It seems to be a question not of whether they'll be here among us, but when. What does that mean for vaccination and also for the continuing need for coronavirus safe practices? We see recommendations that people should double mask or perhaps wear the medically certified N95 masks. We'll get to those questions, but there is a very important issue related to vaccine hesitancy that I'd like to invite you, especially Dr. Kuchandani, and Dr. Koster, because I've heard you talk about this as well. The Las Cruces Bulletin quotes you, Dr. Kuchandani, as saying, our findings show that those who did not believe they could be infected had higher vaccine hesitancy rates, and that individuals who are not concerned about getting infected had higher vaccine hesitancy rates. We might say people who think, I don't think this is going to happen to me. And if it does, it probably isn't going to matter very much. So I'd like the two of you to comment, and also Dr. Dupre and Jeff Fell may want to speak to this. What really makes the difference between whether a person believes that they can't be infected or it won't matter? On the other hand, understanding the risks and taking careful action to reduce the dangers of infection. Dr. Kuchandani, Dr. Koster?
Yeah, I think for me, a part of it comes from how COVID-19 was projected initially, a disease of the old and the sick and the poor, people with chronic conditions. And now, I think many of your audiences may have known 11-year-olds dying, 15-year-olds dying, college students dying. But initially, when we were in the middle of the pandemic, we almost projected this as a disease of the old and the chronically ill people. I think that made some people feel that they're invincible, they are young, they can go out, and it won't be a serious disease. And that's also true for many other public health issues, that many of our young people do not believe that they could be in a traffic accident, and they don't wear a seatbelt. So, you know, and maybe we have to better communicate our data on COVID-19, that no one is risk-free and no one is protected.
Well, this, I think, relates to what Jeff Fell was telling us earlier, that people who may have been pretty nonchalant about the coronavirus, when someone in their family dies or when a good friend becomes very seriously ill and maybe says, you know, I just can't breathe very well anymore, even though I'm classified as recovered, it makes an impression. Dr. Koster, I've heard you speak to this. The difference between a conspicuous example and statistical information is one thing, but in general, what would you have to say about it's not going to happen to me. And if it does, it won't matter much versus I'm going to be very careful.
Well, I wanted to follow up on the doctor's excellent comment about the fact that we started off with the idea that this was a disease of the elderly, in which category I belong. But what's been discovered this past year, because people wondered why is a 40-year-old, a healthy 40-year-old dying of this infection? Why is a healthy 20-year-old? And what was discovered was that there's a set of proteins in every cell that provides that first defense against an invasive virus. These proteins are called interferons. And it turns out that maybe 1 in 1,000, 1 in 500 healthy people have one of these defects. And the only way you discover that that's there isn't any clinical test for it, is by getting infected with a severe infection that doesn't, in which that host doesn't have that good immediate response to restrain the virus, which fortunately 99.9% of us have. But maybe 1 in 1,000 have the defect, and all the best treatment aren't enough. The progress of the infection is so fast that those individuals become overwhelmed and die. So you have to ask yourself, do you want to take that 1 in 1,000 chance of being one of those people that we can't identify and becoming infected and dying? I don't want to take that kind of risk, even though the number is very, very low. Being wrong about it, of course, has a high cost to it. So it's something that we've learned just this past year about these very specific immune defects that we could go through life and never be challenged by any other virus like this. But this virus is an exception. And we've talked earlier about the diminution of the immune response with age, and that certainly is true. But there are those unusual susceptibilities amongst the young. And that needs to get factored into a decision about taking a vaccine or letting nature take its course.
There are a number of really important additional questions to consider. So I'm glad that all of my guests have said that you can be available to continue our discussion next week, because we need to conclude now. We'll be talking about the new, more infectious variants and how they may change the nature of our responses or not, the continuing importance of coronavirus safe practices, additional information about vaccines and vaccinations, education and outreach here in Grant County, and what you in the community can do to help strengthen the community response. You've been listening to the Coronavirus Update interview, a panel discussion today, for February 17th, 2021. My guests have been Dr. Jagdish Kupchandani. He's a professor of public health at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, lead author on a national assessment of COVID-19 vaccination hesitancy in the United States that was published in January of this year in the Journal of Community Health. Dr. Fred Koster, a recently retired infectious diseases specialist in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Jeff Fell, emergency manager and assistant fire chief of Silver City, and Dr. Renee Dupre, a public health consultant in Silver City. Thank you all for being with us today.
Thanks, Jamie.
Thank you.
This interview will be posted for listening and downloading at your convenience on the Coronavirus Update page of our website, gmcr.org, and also on the comprehensive resource website, grantcountycoronavirusupdate.org. That's a collaboration of a group of community organizations in Grant County. Thanks, as always, to Marcus Hansen, our station manager, audio engineer, and producer of Coronavirus Update. And thank you for listening and for supporting GMCR and KURU. Be safe and be well. For Gila Mimbres Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM in Silver City, New Mexico, I'm Jamie Newton.